Today I'd like to tell you about DNA complex with cationic liposomes, which consists of spherical membrane containing a bilayer of lipid molecules. A major motivation for understanding the structures in these complexes comes from the biomedical area, as these complexes are used in gene therapy applications to deliver genes, which are sections of DNA, functional sections of DNA. That's actually one of the main motivations. Another motivation, in fact, is, as you'll see, these complexes turn out to be very interesting systems for looking at DNA phases on two-dimensional membranes. For example, DNA undergoes various condensation-decondensation transitions in two dimensions on membranes. In three dimensions, it's well known, for example, in certain viruses, tobacco mosaic virus, that DNA condenses on a two-dimensional curved surface. It happens to be a protein surface, a positively charged protein surface, but it's still essentially a curved two-dimensional problem. In three dimensions, DNA, of course, undergoes a whole variety of condensation and decondensation transitions. The main questions that I really want to address in the beginning are really the structures in the complexes and the interactions that lead to the complexes, that lead to these structures. But towards the last half of the talk, what I'd really like to do is switch over and show you what the correlation is between structure and transfer into cells in gene therapy. So if you look in three dimensions, DNA condensation and decondensation is pretty well understood it's pretty poorly understood in bacteria. What is known is that DNA condenses with oppositely charged short polyamine groups. If you look in vitro, you can actually see torus-like objects on the scale of about 500 angstroms. At higher concentrations, so this is at low concentrations, at higher concentrations, DNA condenses into very novel columnar hexagonal liquid crystalline phases. A lot of the work that's been done by Françoise-Lise Vollant and is actually quite well known. DNA condensation is best understood, structurally speaking, in eukaryotic cells with nuclei. It's known, for example, that DNA, the first level of condensation is by DNA wrapping around a histone core, forming a nucleosome, which gives rise to a bead on string-like structure. In the presence of salt for screening, because it turns out that these nucleosomes are negatively overcharged, in the presence of salt and another histone particle, which is a positive protein, this self-assembly, this bead on string-like structure, further self-assembles into a chromatin fiber. And from there on, you get more higher-order self-assembly, most of which is not understood, the structure of which is not understood. Of course, just to remind the audience, in this particular case, DNA condenses just before cell division, and decondensation is necessary because DNA has to access the protein template, for example, the transcription factors that turn genes on and off, the polymerases, the machines that actually make RNA and DNA. They have to access the template, which means that this condensed structure has to unravel. Just a short historical note, in fact, the very first evidence for the nucleosome structure was found in small angle diffraction in 1961, and we still, close to 30 years later, we still don't understand the structure at the highest level. We've gone from this discovery in 61 to more or less agreeing on what the chromatin structure is for the moment. What I want to turn to in this talk, the focus of this talk is looking at how DNA is condensed not by positive proteins, which is what happens mostly in vivo, or short polyamines, but rather by cationic liposomes, again, which consist of a bilayer of lipid molecules. Cationic lipids are not native. They're actually slightly poisonous. Most of the charged lipids in your body are actually anionic. But the reason we are interested in studying this really is motivated by the fact that these liposomes are known to be able to carry genes into animal cells. So it's a biomedical motivation, which is plenty good enough for myself. Just a quick reminder of what gene therapy is, sort of a one-page view graph. What you're actually trying to do is deliver a correct copy of a gene. In a case where a gene is destructive, for example, sickle cell anemia, you're actually trying to inactivate a mutated gene. But in most cases, you're just trying to deliver a correct copy. Now, it's known empirically that cationic liposomes, so-called chemical carriers, somehow complex with DNA, and so very much similar to what a virus does naturally. They somehow bypass the cell membrane. An animal cell membrane is always negative, as indicated here. They somehow travel through the cytoplasm and into the nuclear region. Much of what's happening is still actually a mystery. If you look at the current methods of actually delivering DNA, they either use a biological carrier, in other words, a crippled virus, a replication deficient crippled virus, or they use chemical methods, which I'm going to be focusing on today. In either case, the carrier, which has a therapeutic gene, is either directly injected locally. Remember, usually you're doing gene therapy locally. So you either do a local injection or intramuscular. Intramuscular, in fact, is becoming the main pathway now. Or you do what's known as ex vivo. You take out some cells from an affected tissue. You mix it in with the carriers with a therapeutic gene. Somehow, magically, the new cells are transformed. If they're not cancerous, you put them back in. So this is actually the way that it's done. The main advantage, of course, of using a biological carrier, a crippled virus, rather than a chemical method, is evolution. The fact that the viral machinery is incredibly adept at delivering exogenous DNA. The large disadvantage is the size. Most virus capsids can't carry anything larger than 40,000 base pairs, and many important human genes are, if you include the regulatory sequences, are already over 100,000 base pairs with the regulatory sequences, which is really what you want to do ultimately in gene therapy, rather than just deliver the gene. And of course, there are immune responses because viruses, crippled viruses, are stuffed with proteins. So there's an antigen-antibody reaction using this. With the chemical methods, are quite old, the oldest ones being calcium phosphate precipitation. The biggest disadvantage, which is the main problem that everyone is working on right now, is really the fact that the efficiency of transfer is very low. The large advantage is that there really isn't a size limit. As you'll see, this was actually demonstrated about a year ago. These are regular condensed chromosomes. This is actually an artificial human chromosome, which is about a tenth of a normal human chromosome, about 6 to 10 megabases. This human artificial chromosome of such large size was delivered, of course, very, very inefficiently using synthetic methods. There's no other way of doing it right now. The point of making these hacks is you can actually do a lot of pure biology with it because you can study the structure of large pieces of DNA, large genes. And of course, for gene delivery systems, hacks in the end are going to be ideal because you can load them with the genes that are defective and deliver them. That's the idea. But in fact, the main motivation for hacks initially, it's taken this group 10 years to to develop HACCS, the main motivation was just understanding the structure of DNA. So what I want to talk about today, I want to concentrate on cationic liposomes as condensing agents, oppositely charged condensing agents for DNA. This field was really started by Feldner and his collaborators in 1987 in a proceedings of a National Academy paper where they proposed such a bead on string-like structure. They actually found that if they made the complex overall positive, it would attach preferentially to an animal cell and transfection would occur. In fact, clinical trials by Nabel and Nabel have been going on since 1993 and by many other groups. As far as we're concerned, of course, we'd like to understand how this thing actually works. So how does gene delivery work? The fast answer is that, in fact, very little is understood at the molecular and self-assembled levels. There's a pretty comprehensive review article that's becoming outdated now, but it's still a good starting place to start. We're just beginning to understand the structure of these complexes. We know very little about the next question, which is how does the structure interact with the animal cell? How does it traffic? So I'm going to start with the structure of these complexes. And once I've gone through some bit of that, I'll connect it to what we now know, the little bit that we now know in terms of how structure relates to function. The system I'm going to start with, I'm going to start with linear DNA. This is sort of a physicist model of a DNA. It's 48,000 base pairs. It's actually closer to 16.5 microns in contour length. There's also supercoiled DNA. Most functional DNA for actual functional studies is in the form of supercoiled DNA. And the stuff that I'll talk about towards the end of the talk will be primarily on supercoiled DNA. But I'm going to start with linear DNA and go over some of the structures. The lipids that I'll start with, the cationic lipid, DOTAB, is shown here. And normally the lipids are mixed with cationic and neutral lipid, either DOPC or DOPE in this particular case. So the experiments conceptually are pretty straightforward. You prepare liposomes with an average size of 70 nanometers, 700 angstroms, of the mixture of DOTAB and DOPC. You mix them in with lambda DNA. For the average sizes that we start with, charge neutrality is something roughly like within the Feldner picture. If the liposomes were stable, it's something like 4 to 5 liposomes per DNA per DNA molecule.
You're showing it as a 50-50 mixture of cation.
Yes, this is just.
Right,
I'm going to actually be varying that. Because I'm going to control the charge density of the membrane by varying that. But for this particular example, it's a 50-50. Now, when you do this experiment and you just make this mixture. What you see immediately, this is an optical micrograph. This is 10 microns. So you can see that the complexes, the globules that you see that have formed at different L over D, lipid to DNA ratios, are much larger than 700 angstroms. The liposomes you actually can't see on this scale. So you can already see that immediately after you mix the system, condensed globules form. In fact, they turn out to be optically birefringent. You already know from this fact that they're liquid crystalline. Now, charge neutrality for this system with a 50-50 mixture is around total lipid to total divided by DNA ratio of 4.4 weight-weight. That means that these complexes are around the charge neutrality. You can see that the globules are hitting each other. They're sticking due to van der Waals. They're almost charge neutral globules, and they're just growing. The micrographs at this stage are not changed with time. They just grow if you wait long enough. If you look at L over D 50, that's a lot of much more positive. These complexes are, in fact, positively charged. They're strongly positively charged. They seem to repel each other. They never stick. On the other side, L over D with negative complexes, you also see the globules that are charged and don't stick again. So you, in fact, you have a charge reversal through the isoelectric point. You can also measure where's the focus on this thing?
What?
Thanks. You can also measure. You can actually, by dynamic light scattering, you can measure the sizes of these particles, condensed particles. You can see that around the isoelectric point. In fact, they do. The size does grow. Again, these points grow with time. These points on the negative and positive sides are stable. Are stable with time. So the complexes, you can already see, without any more work, that one part of the main structure that you observe is, in fact, cannot just be simple liposomes attached to DNA. They're condensed objects. You can look in double fluorescence mode, so you can tag the DNA with a molecule called yo-yo. You can tag the lipid with Texas red, and you can see that so this consisted of something like four or five of these condensed objects. You can see that the morphology is about the same. This is a highly condensed lipid DNA object. However, if you go to the next step and ask, so this is another, this is again in differential interference contrast optical micrograph, where the complexes are of order. This is the scale here, a micron. If you really want to know what the structure is of these complexes, you either have to use neutron scattering or X-ray scattering. Since these are very dilute, we'd like to look at very dilute samples as well as concentrated samples. Synchrotron diffraction turns out to be an ideal tool for it, since you can go to the densities as low as the ones that are actually used in clinical trials. When you look at the structure of the complexes, what you find is a highly organized structure. In fact, you have a set of layered peaks, 001, 002. The third one is absent for form factor reasons. The fourth one is present that I don't show here. So you have a very well-defined, locally well-defined layered structure. From the repeat distance, we know that it corresponds to exactly a bilayer plus just one monolayer spacing left over for DNA, because we can measure the bilayer spacing separately with X-ray diffraction in the absence of DNA. So we know from the layered structure that in fact there's only one monolayer of DNA alternating with a bilayer of lipids. If you look, you'll see a central broad peak that has a nature. The scattering of this central peak is very different than the sharp lamellar peaks that almost have long-range order. They're three-dimensional symmetrics, so they don't have true long-range order, but they have algebraic decay of correlations, whereas the DNA peak that I'll show you in the next few view graphs, with this broad peak is coming from DNA correlations within the plane. This forms much more of a one-dimensional object, so it's a lower dimensional. That's actually what gives rise to the asymmetry and the broad width of these peaks. So what's actually happened is that when you form this mixture, you get a topological transition into these condensed objects. If you look inside locally on the scale of a few thousand angstroms, because remember, these blobs individually are not much more than about 2,000 to 5,000 angstroms. Locally, you see that in fact it has this lamellar structure. This is actually from a powder diffraction. Now, just very quickly, this is a view graph meant for the title of this conference. I apologize to the more exact people who do numerical simulations, but in fact, this is just a view graph from very old known stuff using nonlinear Poisson-Boltzmann, just in terms of getting a qualitative feel for what the driving force is for self-assembly of such objects. As most of you know, if you take naked DNA, the bare distance between charges is 1.7 angstroms, which is much less than the Biron length. This distance where the Coulomb energy between two unit charges is the thermal energy, that means that the Manning parameter, which is the ratio of the Biron length to the Baire length, because it's much greater than 1, cations will actually condense till the renormalized length approaches 1 again, the renormalized length on the backbone. So in the case of DNA, you have about 80% cation condensation. You also have the same argument more strongly for two-dimensional membranes where you have a condensed layer independent of the charge density. So you can see that DNA and liposomes would like to form these complexes because in the process, they can release their bound cations back into solution. So the self-assembly really is the large gain in entropy of these one-dimensionally bound cations and two-dimensionally bound anions back into solution. Now, if I really want to, what I showed you in the previous view graph in terms of the structure, I hope that I convinced you that there was a layered structure. What I'd like to do is right now show you how we can make a statement about the DNA packing on a membrane in two dimensions. You can do a following so-called dilution experiment. What you do is you start with a membrane, you start with a complex which has membranes which only consist of the cationic lipid. So this is the highest charge density of the membrane. What you find, again, you have your lamellar structure, but you now find a condensed phase of DNA. The DNA peak is a much higher Q, meaning that they're much closer by, which makes sense because you're now also increasing the density of the negative charge density. The negative charge density of the DNA always tries to match, within this picture, tries to match the positive charge density of the membrane. So you can actually stay at the isoelectric point and just keep adding neutral lipid, thus lowering the charge density of the cationic membrane. If the interactions between the rods, between the chains, are repulsive, then in principle, one choice it has is to just follow this charge density and dilute. And this is exactly what happens in the DNA case. You see that the layering stays the same. I'm not doing anything in the Z direction. But the in-plane, you can see that the DNA peak is actually moving in Q. That means that the lattice is expanding. The system, of course, could have also decided to just phase separate. It could have expelled neutral lipid and not expanded. But what you see is that the DNA lattice constant just follows the charge density. And this is the equation that matches the charge density of the DNA to the charge density of the lipid. As I lower the charge density, I lower the charge density of the DNA by also diluting it. So you get a DNA lattice that expands between 25 angstroms, this is almost touching, to close to 50, to close to 60 angstroms. And there are really no adjustable parameters in this solid line. All of the coefficients in front are known quantities that you can measure, the cross-sectional area of DNA, the density of the DNA, the density of the membrane, the thickness of the membrane. So what we really have is on a small scale, we have a one-dimensional lattice. Of course, on large length scales, you cannot have a one-dimensional lattice because you melt into a pneumatic phase, dislocations melt you. But locally, we are able to have something like a smectic phase of DNA aligned in two dimensions. And this is gotten by actually fitting the peaks. If you fit the peaks, what you find is that you don't have liquid-like correlations where you just have near-neighbor correlations. But in fact, you're correlated over about 10 lattice spacings. The asymmetry actually turns out to be a combination of the fact that that you don't have a single crystal. If you had that you actually have to do that, there's a powder average. It gives you an asymmetry. But the width of the peak and the fact I'm not going to go into this. A very detailed line shape analysis was done of the peaks, and you can see that you have fancy exponential correlations of the length. It's consistent with what's expected in lower dimensions. What I really wanted to do was go over the structure, and in the limited time that I have, I wanted to turn to describe some of the work so a lot of this work was done by Ilya Koltover, is my graduate student who just finished. I also wanted to show some of the data of my current graduate students working on correlating the structures with gene transfer. But just to finish up on this, what you see is that this object, so this kind of a cartoon is completely consistent with our data, where you have layers and you have the DNA chains adsorbed. Locally, you can see that you have something that looks like a finite-sized two-dimensional smectin. Of course, again, on larger length scales, dislocations would melt this into an emmatic. If we could prepare a perfect single crystal, in fact, Lubensky and Hearn and Leo Golovovich and Golovovich have described the conditions under which you'd expect to melt this two-dimensional smectic phase. So we really have a hybrid phase of matter. The DNA forms a 2D smectic. The lipid forms a three-dimensional smectic. I'll just show you. This is actually a view graph, one of Tom Lubensky's view graphs, where he and Leo Golovich have independently analyzed the Hamiltonian that describes such objects, such complexes, and they find a very fancy phase that we haven't really found yet experimentally, in addition to the phase that I described, so these are the DNA rods coming out. In their so-called sliding columnar phase, there's actually no positional correlations from layer to layer, but there's orientational correlations from layer to layer. That means that there's actually a response to orientational distortions, but not to positional. It's a very sort of a fancy phase of matter, which, according to their calculation, should exist. Let me now just turn to again asking the question. Here's a cartoon of our animal cell. Here's the nuclear region. How do these complexes, when we drop them on animal cells, how do they actually make their way in? Here's a process known as endocytosis, where the whole complex is initially engulfed, which may or may not fuse later. And I'll come back. So what we would really like to do in this field, in this area, is to correlate the self-assembled structures that we can measure, that we can control, really to biological function. What we mean by biological function in this case is transfer of the gene followed by its expression. So how do we actually do these kinds of experiments? The first thing is, if you look in the literature, again, as I mentioned, Feldner started this field more than 10 years ago. There's a lot of work by literally thousands of workers, empirical data what mixture of lipid makes a good gene transfer complex, what mixture doesn't. For example, it's known that if you use, instead of using DOPC, which is a lipid molecule that has a zero natural curvature that I've been describing so far, if you actually use DOPE, which has a negative curvature, it's been known empirically that in some ratios, 3-to-1, for example, compositions, that these complexes transfect better than DOPC. So this is one bit of empirical data, but it's nothing to be taken because, as I'll show you later on, there are contradictions to this simple rule. But if you just look at the empirical data, this is what the empirical data tells you. It tells you. Yeah, I'll actually, you see it in the next couple of view graphs. The empirical data says the following, Michael, which it says, if I'm taking the cationic lipid DOTAP, It says that if I take this molecule, which has actually a cone shape, it has a negative curvature to it, they know that at 3-to-1 ratios that it transfects better than if I take DOPC and mix it with DOTAB, which has a zero curvature, where the head group is larger. And for example, it's also known that this object, which I'll point to later, which has a spermine head group, which has like 5 positive charges, somehow magically also transfects very well, very at a very high level. So that's what's known empirically. Now, how do we actually measure these transfections? So this is work of Nels Slack, Aisha Ahmed, and Allison Lin. The earlier structural work, a lot of it was Ilya Koltover's work. So what you actually do in these experiments is instead of using lambda DNA, which is a physicist's DNA, you actually use a functional DNA. This is just a sketch of 3 different kinds of functional DNA, the red regions being a reporter gene. So it's actually a gene that we can measure its activity if it successfully makes it into the nucleus and translates a protein. We actually measure for the protein. For example, we use a very common LacZ gene. The expression of LacZ gives rise to the enzyme galactosidase, which has lactose as its substrate. So this is used in E. coli. LacZ is used in E. coli to digest lactose. You can also use XGAL, which is another molecule. It's another galactose, which, when cleaved by this enzyme, turns blue. So it's a very easy marker. You can just transfect your cells, go through the protocol with different lipid mixtures, and then at the end, look and see how many of your cells turn blue. There's a much more quantitative way of doing it, and that's by using by doing photon counting, by using the gene that's responsible for photons for bioluminescence in fireflies, in many early fish, in some bacteria, the luciferase gene. And this is actually a much more powerful assay, because since you're doing photon counting, you have something. It turns out that you have about 5 decades in dynamic range. So you can actually detect very low levels of transfection as well as very high levels, something that you can't do with the LacZ gene. You're just doing photon counting. Just to show you an example, again, so this is an experiment with the XGAL where the blue cells, these are all cells, these small, roughly 20, 30 micron objects that you see, elongated objects. They're happy cells. They're nicely elongated, mostly. This is a case where there's very low transfection for the 3-to-1 PC to TAP. This is a case where there's a much higher transfection rate. This is actually this multivalent that I'll mention at the end, but I just want to focus on these two comparisons. This one has a negative curvature. This one has a zero curvature. If you actually do a luciferase experiment, you can measure this. You can measure this activity much more accurately. This is relative light units. That's 1,000,000 relative light units. Every 10 light units corresponds to about a photon. And this is the translation in nanograms of the enzyme that's produced. The noise in this experiment is 10. So this is 1,000. So you can see that even though with this assay you can't detect anything, with the luciferase you can see around 500, 50 times higher than 50 times higher than background. So this is real data. There is transfection. It's just at a very low level. But it's actually very important to have a powerful assay, because you learn more by trying to optimize this than to try to go to something that's already super optimized in terms of trying to correlate structure to function. For example, this increase by more than a decade around the isoelectric point reproduces. This is something that no one really, there's none of this exists in the literature, because very few people actually do luciferase assays, and very few people actually do phase diagrams. But this increase, which we don't understand right now, is a reproducible feature. So you can now go. So this is actually how we measure. This is how we measure the activity. So you now go back and ask, well, Is there a difference in the structure between these complexes, one that contains PC, one that contains PE? Okay. When you ask that question, so this is now taking the same complexes and now with the DOTAB and just adding DOPE, the lipid that we know that when you get to the 3-to-1 ratio increases its transfection. What you actually see in the scattering is that as you go up into the region that seems more transfected, you actually undergo a structural transition from a lamellar structure to an inverted hexagonal structure with the cone shape. And of course, you can say, at this level, you can say, well, maybe this isn't too surprising because we did put a negative curvature molecule, and the direction of a negative curvature molecule is in fact to go towards the H2 phase. But I'll show you some stuff which is also less trivial. But let's get back to this. We can actually understand how to control the interactions by, of course, looking at the relevant interactions, electrostatics being one of them, and the membrane elasticity another one. The electrostatics, it's been shown recently, theoretically, if you also think about it qualitatively, you'll see that the electrostatics always favors an inverted structure where DNA is completely wrapped by the positive cations because you have the least separation of charge in this case compared to a lamellar phase. However, this curving can be strongly opposed by the membrane elasticity. If you start with a membrane that has a very large bending rigidity, then the only way to actually go into the H2 phase, which the electrostatics favors, is by changing the natural curvature. And that's exactly what happens. Of course, this qualitative argument has been done out in recent papers by Ben Shaul and by Neely Dan and co-workers, where you find that basically the simple analysis, which is that if I start with membranes that have a natural curvature and a bending rigidity that is much larger than kappa, then the lamellar phase just dominates, even though the electrostatics wants the H2. The only way to actually get such a system, which is rigid, to go into the H2 phase that the electrostatic favors is basically by going to a finite non-zero curvature. However, you can actually carry this out one step further. So this is the pathway by just going from a C0 equals zero to a negative curvature membrane. It turns out that you can actually undergo this phase, same transition in another way, which is you can stay with a membrane that wants to be flat, but just reduce its bending rigidity, which you can do by adding co-surfactant molecules. In that case, because electrostatics wants the H2 phase, it doesn't care if it deviates from C0. C0 is, so it pays the elastic cost because kappa is small. It just snaps into the electrostatic configuration. So this is what's being seen experimentally. At this point, this pathway has not been analyzed theoretically. So right now I've shown you two structures, but we really want to go to the next question, which is why does the inverted hexagonal phase transfect better than the lamellar phase, the complex phase? We'd really like to go to the next step and understand more of what's happening. This is where the only way you can get a better understanding is, in fact, to do some animal cell studies. What's known from the literature, these are the authors, and in fact Allison Lin has reproduced some of these results, is that if you look at complexes interacting with an animal cell, at the very early stage, the main method, the main pathway of getting in seems to be through endocytosis, where, remember the animal cell has a negative membrane. Very early on, you form an endosome, which is just a vesicle, a negative vesicle, that encloses the complex. So at a very early stage in cell transfection, You have a complex inside of a cell vesicle. You can do two types of experiments to try to understand this interaction between a complex and a negative vesicle. You can either do a model experiment looking at how the complex interacts with giant liposomes, and this has been done by Coltover, or you can do in vitro experiments with animal cells where you look at how the complex actually interacts with animal cells. You can do both experiments. Let me just show you quickly, when you do the model experiment, so this is taking a giant liposome that's negative and attaching the positive complexes onto the liposome. So if you do two experiments, if you do one with the lamellar phase complexes that I showed you early on, what you notice is that the complexes, here are some complexes here, here's some over there, here's some over here. You can see in fluorescence mode that they're more distributed. What you see is that in the lamellar phase, they seem to remain stable for long periods of time. If you take a hexagonal complex, on the other hand, you immediately see a violent event as it comes in contact with an oppositely charged membrane. You see what seems to be rapid fusion. When you look in fluorescence in the DNA mode, you can see that the DNA is now sloshing around and it's basically unbound. So it's actually consistent with because remember, you have cationic lipids in the complex and anionic in the membrane. If they mix rapidly, you'll get almost charge-neutral membranes and release of DNA. But the lamellar phase basically did not lead to this fusion. If you do the same experiments, so you can now follow it. These are actually in mouse cells, work of Allison Lin. Here's actually a healthy mouse cell. This is 10 microns. This is a nuclear region. This is in differential interference contrast. So this is after you've transfected them with cells. These are now transfecting them with cells that have the lamellar structure, that alpha structure. You can look to follow the complex in situ. You look in double fluorescence mode. So you can look in the middle. All the dots that you see are where the DNA is in the complex. All the dots here are for the lipid. The overlap is all the complexes are where the overlaps occur, and to simplify your viewing, I've actually put circles taken from this middle one. So you can see there are actually a large number of complexes, but you can see they're intact. If you use confocal microscopies, if you now do three-dimensional imaging, so this is actually going to an image, making a cross-section and looking. This is a top view. This is a side view looking inside a cell. So this is about 10 microns. This is the nuclear region. On the left side, what you see is an experiment. Again, the complex is the DNA. The DNA is green. The lipid is red. So all the yellow overlap are complexes. You can do an experiment at 4 degrees where endocytosis is inhibited, and you can see that most of the complexes are on the outside. So this is consistent with what other people have reported, that endocytosis seems to be an important pathway, at least for these structures. We're finding that, in fact, it's not a universal pathway for different structures, but I don't really have time to get into that. For the lamellar complexes, we see clearly that they stick to the surface. The complexes stick to the surface. If you do the same experiment at 37 degrees physiological conditions, you can see that the complexes have come in, but what you actually see is that the complexes are intact inside the cell. There's excess lipid, because this is on the positive side, where the complexes coexist with excess lipid. So you can see in animal cells directly, this is a very complicated system, but you can still see that the lamellar complexes are essentially intact in the cell cytoplasm. Where? A, B, or C? Well, ignore this part. There's a shadow. Oh, so the yellow is where there's an overlap between DNA, green and red. So that's a complex. So all the reds are mostly lipid. All the yellows are complexes. But of course, even here, there's some yellow in it. Did you ever think? Actually, at this point, there is no Here's an experiment where there was a technical problem in these experiments where you see this green background because the DNA is not covalently bound. The dye is not covalently bound to the DNA, so it leaves. It goes and actually gets soaked up by the chromosome. So ignore this diffuse green background. Here's an experiment where the dye that labels the DNA is actually covalently bound, and it can't go to the chromosome. And so you can see it's very clean. These are all complexes, and this is mostly excess lipid. But of course, you can see that there's some yellow in these images. Between this and this? In A? How are you supposed to understand what? This is the outline of the cell. Okay? This is a cross section this way. This is about 10 microns. This is the surface.
They look similar. Why do they have different colors?
Because there are more complexes here than there. I mean, there's yellow. The DNA is labeled green. The lipid is labeled yellow. Red, and then the mixture, if it's equal mixtures, is yellow, but depending on exactly how much of one you have versus the other, it's going to be different. I mean, right now, I have the most complexes are aggregated in this cut at this point. There are less complexes there.
Does that mean that some complexes have different compositions than others?
Probably not. It's mostly aggregation. Because we actually see, if you do these experiments, without the cell, but using the salt conditions of the cell, you can see aggregation. But I mean, the main these are very preliminary data. This data is a couple of months old. The main thing I really want you to take from this image is the fact that, as you can see in DIC from the top, and when you look inside, the complexes are more or less intact in the animal cell. We know we have excess lipid. A lot of this redness was there because we use positive complexes to attach to negative membranes. Positive complexes coexist with lipid, with excess lipid. If you do the same experiment with the hexagonal structure, and I don't have, so this is just the DIC image. If you do the exact same experiment with the hexagonal structure, what you find is completely different. You find that here's a cell that we're looking at. You can see in the lipid mode that there's quite a bit of fusion that's occurred with the plasma membrane. You still see complexes. These are overlapping. One is in lipid mode, one is in DNA, so these are complexes. In fact, this at 50%, this wasn't pure H2. There was a coexistence of H2 and lamellar. But the main thing that you see is a striking difference. I mean, you see fusion here, the way you saw in the model liposomes that you don't see in the lamellar phase. And you can actually follow, you can do the same thing. You can actually follow the same experiment. So this is actually direct imaging, and these experiments are just getting going. You can also follow, and this is some very preliminary data, you can follow the same thing with diffraction again in animal cells. This is actually an example of a tissue which consists of a self-assembly of cells. These are each cells. These are about 10 microns. You can transfect these cells and, again, follow them. If you have enough of them, you need about 1 million of them in the X-ray beam to actually get a signal. What you actually see is consistent, but this now is integrating, whereas the direct imaging was looking at particle by particle. You can actually see, so this is diffraction. In the case of lamellar complexes, this is exactly the peak position of the lamellar complex. This is now the complex in the cell. If you do the same experiment with the hexagonal phase, you see essentially no evidence of much of a complex diffraction. So this is actually you've seen it now sort of three times: one in a model system, one in direct imaging, and this time in diffraction. What seems to be happening, I mean, here's just one example of a correlation between structure and gene transfer, is the fact that the lamellar phases in most of the regime seem not to fuse as readily as the hexagonal phases. So you can imagine two different pathways that the complex uses to enter a cell, either endocytosis, where it goes in an endosome, and then it fuses and gets out if it's a hexagonal, phase, or direct fusion with a plasma membrane. We actually have some recent evidence that depending on where you look in the phase diagram, you can get direct fusion with the plasma membrane. But I do want to caution because of the complexity of cells, there are more unknowns than knowns. We know very little in terms of how structures correlate to their transferability. We can, for example, now design a lamellar phase in one part of the phase diagram that in fact does transfect. We don't know exactly what the mechanism is, but empirically we know it does transfect 100 times larger, within a factor of 10 of the hexagonal structure. I don't really want to get into that because we have some data. All I wanted to say is that I certainly do not want to leave the impression at the end of my talk that hexagonal phases transfect and lamellar phases don't. If you remember earlier on, I showed, when I showed the luciferase data, and the reason I'm not answering you, Bill, is not because I'm trying to avoid it. It's because I don't know the exact answer. We're still doing experiments. We're exploring it. I mean, and I don't want to guess. Here's just to show you this feature. So this is a lamellar phase that transects very poorly. And it goes up. Remember, this is on log, so it's going up close to close to a decade and a half. Reproducibly, this is a reproducible feature. The charge density has changed. So there are physical parameters that have changed, and we're looking at that right now. We know that the aggregation changes, the charge density changes, and we're looking at experiments. That's what I meant. But since I don't know, you know, I don't even have one case where it's clean, I just don't want to get into it. Let me just point one thing out before I stop. And the observation that the L-alpha does not fuse is really not at all obvious. In fact, the L-alpha should fuse. If you look at the literature where they talk about fusion, they're always talking about fusion between two vesicles that are charge neutral. And then they invoke an inverted hexagonal pathway for fusion. So you will, in fact, read a lot of papers on fusion, even though we don't understand it, that say fusion occurs if somehow there's an inverted structure. So you may glibly just say, well, you have an H2 phase, it's an inverted structure, so it should fuse. But in fact, the puzzle is why the lamellar phase doesn't fuse. Because I'm looking at a positive object and a negative object. In both cases. I mean, the thing is that if I ask about the membrane, in both cases, the entropy of mixing would favor the fusion. Also, I lower the electrostatic energy because I neutralize the membrane. So the lamellar phase should fuse. In fact, we've gone back. We've done experiments where we now know that the fact that one fuses and the other one doesn't is really a kinetic effect. There's a barrier because we see that if we wait long enough, in fact, the lamellar phase does fuse. And these gene therapy experiments that are done, they're strongly time-dependent. We're now doing the partial answer to Bill's question. We're actually doing time-dependent experiments, and there's a strong time dependence because whether you come in with endocytosis or fusion are completely different timescales. But anyway, this is what I really wanted to leave you with, which is that the fact that the L-alpha doesn't fuse, because this is also telling us that we can design lamellar phases which should fuse. So I'll just finish up by, let me just show you my... Well, I have to obviously show you my collaborators, but let me just show you a couple of favorite view graphs, which is that, I mean, ultimately the direction we're going is, remember what I said at the beginning was that these non-viral synthetic methods, the main reason to even be studying them is the fact that we can handle large pieces of DNA that you can't handle with a virus. Most diseases, here's a chart of an old chart that's actually, even though it's from Time magazine, it's used in, this is reproduced from a molecular biology textbook from 1994, which shows, so this is very old right now, but even at this level it shows, for example, that many diseases are multi-gene diseases. And ultimately, you do... So these are the 46, 20, 22 pairs plus XY chromosomes, human chromosomes. Right. And this is just from 94, showing a selection of known known diseases at that time. For example, Alzheimer's now has been linked to four different regions on four different chromosomes. But most diseases, certainly most cancers, are multi-gene diseases. And ultimately, it's really the human artificial chromosomes that have to be developed. These are very large pieces of DNA that you can't even imagine making synthetically. You're talking about 10 to the 10 molecular weights. And of course, manipulating these objects, here's an artificial human chromosome, is non-trivial, because if you try to do that without condensation at all times, you're going to be shearing the very fragile polymer. But this is really where this business of looking at synthetic methods wins over viral methods, even though right now viral methods of carrying genes in still dominates. So the students who worked on this project, Ilya Koltover, who just finished, is going to be doing a postdoc at MIT. Allison Lin and Nell Slack, Allison did all of the imaging that I showed you. Nell Slack and Aisha Ahmed have done all the transfection experiments that I've shown you. These are materials and physics students. Joachim Radler was a very important collaborator on the lamellar structure. He was a postdoc here a few years ago. Tim Saldit actually did the line shape analysis that looked at the details of the DNA line shape. And of course, we have collaborators from industry, biotech industry, to get functional, specialized functional DNA. And we have a very important collaborator, Chuck Samuel, who was chair of biology at MCDB on campus. Cyril George and his group is responsible for training Allison, Nell, and Aisha, and a lot of the cell biology methods that I showed today. And of course, this is a subject that I didn't get to at all, that we're working on with these complexes. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Cyril.
Yeah.
You know what I think about this work.
How well does the cell survive the process of this crisis?
In most cases, when you if you look at the optimal regimes for optimal transfection, in those regimes, the cell damage seems to be negligible. You can measure, for example, total amount of proteins, but the damage seems to be low. In some cases where we use a lot of, because we actually do a phase diagram, when we go to the very high lipid to DNA ratios, you can visibly see that the cells have committed suicide. So you can actually see that. We're developing an assay right now to measure it more quantitatively with protein. But cationic lipid toxicity is not an issue compared to other toxins that are injected in patients. It's negligible. There's definitely a hydration layer. For example, in the lamellar phase, because we can't get closer than 24, 25 angstroms, no matter how hard we pack it. We've also packed it osmotically. And bDNA is 20 angstroms, so there's definitely a hydration layer. around the DNA.
What happens if you have a very dilute system, say in a lamella system? Can you have two layers of lipid membranes so that you will have the signal arrangement, but with two layers of lipid system, if say lipid is weakly charged?
Well, if you take the hexagonal structure,
yes,
and open up the monolayer into bilayers, then you'd get like a rectangular structure. Let me finish and you see. You'll get a rectangular structure where very similar to what, for example, Lewinsky has worked out. And there is some data from Radler's group now in Germany where he suggests that he's found the rectangular lattice where you have correlations between the DNA molecules across bilayers.
I'm talking about rigid membranes.
Yes.
Rigid.
Yes.
You're not talking about the trapping.
Lamellar.
Yeah, but you can have two layers of membrane.
Four monolayers?
Four monolayers.
We have no evidence of that.
You still have hexagonal lattice.
I mean, we don't have any evidence for that.
You have another phase in it. You can expand the extravision.
I mean, you know, this is a very complicated system, right? There are many components. And what we've done is along certain lines in composition space.
Okay. Yeah, you have shown us that you can actually wrap a lot of genetic material in your vesicles. Can you now summarize where are the key stages in the gene therapy? Is it at the level of getting the material in, or at the level of getting material inside the cell, or releasing it? So there's basically like three stages seen here.
But all of them come in. I mean, the thing is that...
Yeah, sure. Is it kinetically important, then we should speak about redetermining stages, or it has some other meaning? Can you comment on that?
I mean, the thing is that, you know, what we're finding right now is that, for example, the complex apparently has no problem getting in. That doesn't seem to be a major barrier. What does seem to be a major barrier is what happens in the cytoplasm.
Uh-huh.
And so we find regions where the complex, one images that I showed, can either rapidly fuse on some time scale, if they're in the H2 phase, with membranes inside and release the DNA, or they may fuse very slowly if they're in the lamellar phase. We've also found regimes where other macromolecules seem to be competing with cationic lipids for DNA, actually sucking DNA out, because you do have positively charged macromolecules inside the cell cytoplasm that compete with cationic lipids. So it's very complicated. I mean, right now, where we are focusing our efforts is mostly in the cytoplasm, the time scales for release of DNA and the mechanisms. We know that there are several mechanisms. If you read the literature, they only talk about one mechanism, fusion with the endosome. We have data that suggests there are at least two mechanisms, and I'm sure more. No, the nucleosome is exactly known. There's beautiful crystallography work.
In fact, what I said
it twice is that this was first seen in 1961, and that's the only thing we really know now from crystallography, that the chromosome is not known.
No.
But that's the structure of there are four particles, two
right.
Particles.
The first evidence for it.
I got an impression from you that single nucleus.
It's known. Two angstroms.
Yes.
Two angstroms. It's known. Actually, the size so far doesn't seem to be the size of the DNA, because Ilya's experiments are lambda DNA is, it's 48,000 base pairs, 17 microns long. We've looked at 8,000 base pairs. A lot of the functional data that you saw at the end, Allison and Nell's work on supercoil, they're four or five times smaller. The size of what seems to matter a lot is actually this is the aggregates that form. Once there's a globule, so you may have 10 DNA molecules or 40, because that size seems to be a constant, this 2,000 angstrom average particle size. But then the other lane scale where they actually stick, because in DMEM, which is this solution that's used for animal cell work, there's about 100 millimole of salt. There's a lot of screening going on. You can actually see the globules aggregate. That seems to be pretty critical. But the DNA size may be important. It's probably more quantitative at a quantitative level rather than qualitative, the size of the DNA.
When I come to the issue of kinetics, if I think of these as phase transformations, then I would want to understand the surface, which is usually where things happen. And it would seem to me, and I don't know what evidence you have or can get, that the surfaces of the lamellar phases are much more closed things than the surfaces of the hexagonal phases. Much more open and fuzzy, and I would have thought that that was both possibly understood,
right.
Understandable, and would affect right. The kinetics very strongly.
Right. I didn't show this, but sort of exactly what you just said. Let me just draw it in a cartoon. In a lamellar phase, if you look at the last bilayer, the surface one, it's actually a bilayer. If you look at the inverted hexagonal phase, because it has tails sticking out. The last layer is actually a monolayer because there's water on the outside. And this last layer is not happy because it's at a positive. So your observation is exactly right, which is that right at the beginning, the hexagonal phase is not happy with its surface layer, or the lamellar phase is.
Can that be the main example?
That's probably one of the main. That actually probably is. We're actually just starting to do those experiments.
And do you have any idea in terms of the distribution of charges on the lipids? Do you see any evidence of an importance for the distribution of the charges of the lipid head?
We're just starting to look at these multivalents that have everything I showed you was a univalent. We're looking at divalents and multivalents. So all we know now is that you can actually, that multivalents in the lamellar phase seem to be very transfectant, seem to fuse. So we don't understand that. So there does seem to be a strong effect on the charge distribution in the head group. But we're just starting those.
Sure. Do people ever try to transfect the DNA already wrapped with histones? They must have tried.
Yeah, actually they are doing those. I mean, one of the things... One reason so people have done that, but the main reason against it is that your body violently attacks histones. Histones never see the outside of a cell, right? They're inside, so they're antigens. As soon as they get out, they're treated as foreign particle, and there's an immune response.
But you could have a skin of lipid around the whole thing.
You could, but there have been experiments. You know, if you actually do exactly what you said, which is a good idea, because in fact there are papers that have tried it. If you try to do that in vivo, there's a very strong immune reaction. So as you have to protect the histone. You have to actually coat it with something.
In the mixed lipid systems, is there any evidence of reorganization of lipid cells that put the positive groups in a pattern that's more complementary to the DNA?
When we draw our cartoons, we sort of suggest that, but we don't have any direct evidence.
We calculated the charge.
So Avi can. I mean, we.
So our charge modulations, I think Jochen claiming that he also got some by fluorescence. You mean the modulation of the charge in the complex?
Right, around the DNA.
Yeah.
That's actually one of the big problems in this field, which is that when they show you transfection data, like the ones I just showed you, and I'll bring it up since you asked the question. They always show you transfection in dividing cells. Dividing cells don't have a membrane. The membrane dissolves. That's actually why the transfection rates are so high. If you actually do experiments in fully differentiated cells, which is what we're going to start doing, the story is then different, because then you have what you said. There's a nuclear barrier to overcome. in some sense, 99% of what you see in the literature, and no one ever tells you that, unless you're like an expert in the field, everything is done in dividing cells.
Last question, Marcia.
No. The fact that you are both doing microorganisms, it doesn't mean that you have to have a lot of stuff in your body in order to form the content, that you have to have a lot of kind of to form the content, naturally form. I'm not meaning to form outside and first the complex already done, but you want to form naturally form the complex.
What do you mean? The thing is, remember, the cationic lipids are like little poisons, right?
Yeah.
But if you're talking about... But what?
In order to form the micro, we have to have a lot of them.
Right, right. And a particle.
And already a lot around.
Right.
I mean that
the cationic lipids or surfactants will associate with the DNA about a factor of 20 below the CMT.
Mm-hmm.
So did anybody ever look at transfection for very small concentrations of cationic lipids or surfactants?
All the data that I've seen is essentially at the level where you have liposomes already formed.
So nobody looked at small.
Probably some people have. I don't know. Also the assays that people do are not very sensitive. Like in X-Gal assay, you would not even detect that. But in the cephalase, you may detect it.
Two short ones. One, there was another structure that Sternberg reported some years ago, which is called the spaghetti that is
right.
By a bilayer, which could be a metastable.
Well, that structure,
it shouldn't be stable.
I mean, let me just comment on it. I mean, when you're on the negative side, as you guys have done, Robin has done, Brunsma has done, and we have seen experimentally, when you're on the negative side of complexes, you coexist with naked DNA, and certainly those DNA molecules may have a bilayer coating them. So I'm almost positive that the images that they've seen, because several groups have seen them, are probably real images, but they're the excess DNA.
No lipid around.
Well, no, there may be a lipid coating it, because that's probably a lower energy than not having it.
But then you then we can talk about it. But then you have a competition. You can ask why they don't join the bigger complex.
On the negative side, you have excess DNA in solution.
On negative?
That's what I mean. So I think all of the images that they show actually is the ones that they've seen are on the negative side.
Fine.
Then you have excess.
Why don't they go into the complex?
Well, you go in up to some level and then expel the rest. In your own theory, right? I mean, you take in some DNA, and then you expel the rest. And I think when you do a freeze fracture, it's not a very controlled experiment. It's not easy to control the where you are in the phase and around the isoelectric point. I can easily see...
You also have pieces going in from one globule to the next or something like that, which would...
Well, maybe we stop at this point. We have many questions for the day talk.